I'm very concerned if we don't pass this bill today that this will be an initiative.
If they don't listen to the will of the people will speak.
We can be reasonable, we can communicate, we can be respectful, we can be civil, we can find common ground.
And if our partners buckle under this political pressure, if the hard choices just become too hard, then we'll just keep moving forward.
Mr. Speaker, in conclusion, the $10 founding father without a father who got a lot farther by working a lot harder, by being a lot smarter, by being a self-starter, by 14, they place him in charge of a trading charter.
Welcome to 45 Days, a KUER news podcast where we break down week by week the bills, lawmakers, and events of the 2017 Utah legislative session. I'm Terry Gilday, KUER's news director, and I'm in studio with reporters Judy Faze, Lee Hale, and Nicole Nixon. Hi.
Hello.
Wow. Week three of the session. It just gets better and better. And we started off with an interesting hearing on Monday night. This was about a bill, a sex education bill, that Representative Brian King is running again. This is the minority leader of the House. Brian King is probably the most powerful Democrat on the Hill. And this was a bill that would allow parents to opt in to a couple of different sex education programs in schools, I believe abstinence only, and then one that goes beyond abstinence in its education process. Lee, you covered the House Education Committee hearing on Monday night. What happened, and how did Representative King make his case that having choices in sex education is important in Utah schools?
Well, a lot happened. You said the word interesting. If by interesting you mean 4 hours long, it was a very interesting meeting. There's a lot of public comment. Basically, the bill, from the way King described it to the committee, was that right now we have one opt-in option for sex ed in the state. Basically, it has to be based on abstinence. And whether that's abstinence only or whether that's kind of like an interpretation, basically you can never promote sex. You can never promote, you know, anything but beyond abstinence as a teacher. And so he wanted to do a new option. Basically, parents can opt into another version of that, which is, you know, they can talk more about contraception. They can talk about STDs. They can talk about things that he said are real problems in the state. And we're kind of in denial that they're not problems. And with that, basically, in a little discussion, they asked for people to raise their hands who wanted to make a comment. And basically everyone in the room raised their hands and formed two gigantic lines for and against and proceeded to talk for about 2 hours. And I learned a lot about Utah politics during that time. But people felt very strongly about this, understandably. But, you know, some of those arguments seem like arguments have been going on for a very long time. And one of the things that Representative King brought up that was really important to him was how teachers right now are kind of walking on eggshells with sex ed. And this is something he said in the committee hearing about why he thinks this bill would be a good idea.
If you cross the line from defining and discussing to describing or to advocating or encouraging that, you have committed a crime as a teacher. And what I hear from our public educators is that's a very hard line to negotiate at times, especially when you're trying to respond to kids' questions.
So is that truly that Utah teachers would be committing a crime? Is that hyperbole, or what is King saying?
It's against
that?
The law. Yes, I mean, is a police officer going to jump in and arrest the teacher on the spot? I don't think so. There's a branch of the Utah State Board of Education that handles these kind of complaints. Let's say a parent gets word, there's a way it goes up. The teacher's not going to go to prison, but it is illegal. And I was talking to Nicole, because she's of the four of us, she's the only one that had sex ed in Utah.
Or lack of sex ed in
Utah. But you told me a story about one of your teachers.
Yeah, in 10th grade, you asked me what sex ed was like in Utah, and I said I don't remember because I don't think I had it. I do remember one day my teacher asked if we wanted to learn a little bit, and he made us promise and, you know, just swear that we wouldn't tell our parents. And anybody who didn't want to hear anything left the room for about 10 minutes. And I think it was so basic. I think he talked about, like, what condoms do, and I think he showed us some gross pictures of STD.
Yes.
But that was it.
And it's one of those things that you don't envy a teacher who has to teach us, right? Nobody does. But it's a conversation that has to happen, and King was saying it's usually not happening in, or maybe not usually, but oftentimes it's not happening in the home. So he said, you know, this bill would allow the parents to opt in for them to have basically these question and answer experiences with their teachers where the teacher's not walking on eggshells, where they can just really speak freely about things that worry them, about things these kids should know. And he said, if they don't get it there, who knows where they're going to get it.
And this is not Brian King's first foray into trying to pass legislation to reform sex ed in Utah. One of the first House floor debates that I covered in 2012 when I first arrived to Utah was a discussion about one of King's pieces of legislation and about how parents talk to their children about sex and sex education. And it was almost as awkward probably as your 10th grade class.
Very awkward.
I think that we had a group full of adults who were parents. And they're lawmakers in the Utah House of Representatives, and they really had no clue about how to talk to kids about sex.
Right. And yes. and it's like my heart goes out to parents in that situation.
Glee, I wanted to ask you, you said at the outset that you had learned a lot about Utah politics by covering this discussion. Can you give us some insight? What did you learn?
Well, most of that came at the end because... So this was a very long hearing, 4 hours. There was another bill discussed, but most of it was this bill. And because I was listening and waiting, I started kind of doing an outline of my script for the night, you know, my story. And I kind of did a preparatory introduction, and I thought that it was going to pass. And so I started writing, well, this bill passed through committee today. And I, just me listening kind of ignorantly, I was like, well, this sounds good to me. Like, it seems like it was catered for Republican representatives and Republican their constituents. Very careful wording. Very careful approach. But then at the end, the committee started talking in a way where I thought, oh, wow, this isn't going to happen. But there's this vibe in the room. Basically, we know this is a good idea, but we're not sure how to go about it. And here's Francis Gibson, a Republican representative, talking about it.
For those of you who oppose this bill, I hope by no means we somehow think that we don't have issues and that we don't have teen pregnancy. And we don't have kids out seeking answers from places they probably shouldn't be seeking them.
So he wasn't alone in sharing that sentiment where it's like, we're not doing it right. We know there are problems, but we're just not ready to do anything about it yet. And he goes on to say, he said to Brian King, he said, it does not matter what you wrote in that bill, no one in red was going to support it. And that was the moment I think I learned a lot about Utah politics. I had this experience listening where I thought, of course, these like everyone's coming around. We're kind of feel like we're on the same page. And then he drops that. Sure enough, everyone just voted down the party line. And no one in red supported it. And I just kind of, I feel like I just kind of, it was a little lesson package for me.
So the bill was defeated 12-2. What's next? I mean, is there a possibility in the session for Representative King or a person in the House or Senate to bring this up again? Is it done for the session?
It sounds like it's done for the session. And it sounds like this is going to be a yearly thing. And it sounds like this. There's almost an identical committee hearing, people said, happened last year. And there probably will be another one next year because, you know, Representative King said, I'm not going away. This isn't going away. I think the committee kind of said, we appreciate the conversation this year and we'll see it. We'll see you later. They didn't give any indication of what that might look like down the line when they do, you know, confirm or vote to approve a bill. But I don't think it's going to be anytime in the near future.
Well, we'll be around for Groundhog Day when it comes to Sex Ed Day on the Hill next week.
Right.
More movement this week on the fight over federal control of lands. Last week, Governor Herbert signed a non-binding resolution that asks President Trump to rescind the new Bears Ears National Monument. This is the one that President Obama designated in the final days of his administration. This week, the Utah Senate passed another resolution that asks Congress to shrink the Grand Staircase Escalante National Monument. And the Outdoor Industry Association stood up against Utah lawmakers threatening to move the Outdoor Retailers Trade Show. This is an enormous twice-yearly show out of Salt Lake, where it's been for years, if lawmakers move ahead with opposing these national monuments. Judy, you're on top of the story every day. What's going on and how high are the stakes here? This is a big deal.
Well, I think it's going to continue to be an interesting discussion that we're going to have. It's probably going to push the public lands debate into some new dimensions that we haven't really seen, because ultimately the bigger issue here, at least the outdoor industry wants it to be the main issue on the table, is there a cost for Utah's politics? Is there a cost behind not accounting for a huge portion of the economy? So the outdoor retailers did a study back in 2012 where they said nationally the outdoor recreation industry was worth $646 billion, $12 billion in Utah alone, and, you know, over 100,000 jobs here in Utah. So that's a pretty big industry. I think it outstrips oil and gas, if I remember correctly. And so it's a factor in our economic landscape. But we have this mindset that only maybe energy industry jobs seem to matter. And so one of the people I spoke with at the Outdoor Industry Show earlier this month was a guy named Phil Powers. He's the CEO of the American Alpine Club, which is just a group of rock climbers. And I asked him on the floor what he thought about this idea that the Outdoor Industry Association should become involved in Utah politics.
This show is worth $50 million a year in direct benefit to Utah. The indirect benefit is far more than that, but it's a way to get the message out there that this is worth millions and millions of dollars to this state. Do you want it or not? And if you want it, then listen to our concerns.
The Outdoor Industry Association has been meeting in Utah, I want to say, for almost 2 decades. And this threat has come up before. It came up in 2012. And at that time, the state created an Office of Outdoor Recreation. It's now occupied by a guy who used to work in the outdoor retail industry for 2 decades, Tom Adams. And what I'm hearing is that people really see that there's a value to this industry, not just for the trade shows in Salt Lake City, but the ecosystem that the trade shows seems to generate. So the Outdoor Industry Association on Wednesday this week went to Washington and met with members of the congressional delegation. They said they were dismissed, but they also issued a call to arms to the members of the association and said, look, we're big and we're real, and Congress and Utah need to pay attention to us when we say we want to protect public lands.
Can I ask a question, Judy?
Yeah, yeah.
I've been thinking about this because I remember there's this moment when I was flying from LA, where my parents live, back to Utah, and it was the week of Outdoor Retailer, and all these people just filling this airplane, just these cool looking people, right? with the perfect outdoor gear. And I had this sense of pride where I was like, I live where they're going. Like, everyone wants to be in Salt Lake right now, and that's where I live. And so I think that, along with the money, like you're saying, that there is a sense of pride that people come here to do this thing. But the question I keep on having in my mind as I read about this and think about this is, you know, they're saying we want Utah to respect federal public lands. But it's almost like saying if we don't have federal lands, that means that we are against all things outdoorsy, which is not the sense I get from people who, you know, I feel like there's a lot of legislators who love the outdoors. It's not that they hate the outdoors, but it almost seems like these outdoor retailers are trying to say, if you don't support public lands, you hate all things outdoors. You hate, you know, you hate rock climbing, you hate skiing. And that's just what's weird to me, is the assumption that one leads to the other, right?
Well, it sounds like the message that lawmakers are starting to adopt is resonating with you, because I was really impressed, whether it was the Grand Staircase Monument Bill resolution, excuse me, or if it was the Bears Ears National Monument Bill, Republican legislators were saying, hey, we're a public land state. Greg Hughes said public land state. Mike Noel said public land state. Ralph Okerlund said public land state. All of these are part of their floor speeches, saying, hey, we love public lands. We love you outdoor retailers. So I think that it leaves this tension out there about what's going to happen next. And next week, there's a meeting that's planned with Governor Gary Herbert between the Outdoor Industry Association and the outdoor retailers. And again, I anticipate that we're going to be hearing about this for a while. I think the legislators say they resent people from outside of Utah injecting their opinions into this debate. But the fact is that they're federal lands. And in this case of the Bears Ears National Monument, for instance, there's no new federal land that's part of that. All we're talking about is a change in the management policies.
Yeah.
And it's ironic, too, because Mike Noel was the floor manager for the House Concurrent Resolution 12, the Grand Staircase Escalante measure. And he was really careful to say that, you know, the same laws that apply on the national monument also apply on a not national monument that's federal lands.
But it sounds like if you're Patagonia, what they're saying is, we want to be federal lands, though. We don't want you to change any of that. It sounds like they're very firm in the sense that, I mean, is it just most comforting to them to think of them as federal lands? Like, they don't like the idea of state-managed public lands?
I think the state's efforts to do the federal lands transfer, where the states would control what happens on the federal lands, is scary to the environmental groups, because they don't see the state being as interested in protecting and preserving, conserving resources as the environmental groups do, and as the cultural resources do, as the Native Americans do. You know, and can I say personally that I understand who's right or who's wrong? I can't. In Ralph Okerlund's floor speech, that Senator Ralph Okerlund, he represents Monroe, Republican in the central part of the state, which covers these two monuments. He talked about the importance of sort of doing a do-over for the Grand Staircase Escalante Monument. Even though it's been in place for 20 years, there are local businesses who say it's great, they love it, but the legislature basically set in motion these mechanisms for Congress and the local political leaders to shrink the boundaries. And some of the boundaries that I've heard about were very, very small, like a third of the size. So how do you unprotect the land, and how do you tell people to change their thinking all over again? At any rate, at one point on the floor, as the senator was concluding his remarks, he basically said, locals want to have a say in the discussion. And this is exactly what the outdoor industry is saying. We want to have a say in the discussion.
We are asking for a chance for all of us to be involved in this process and be able to make some decisions that make sense, and to make sure that the next generation does not grow up hating what has happened to them by the stroke of a pen, but to be involved in the process and make it work and prosper for everyone down there.
So, Judy, I have a question for you. Is this leverage that the Outdoor Industry Association is putting on the state of Utah, is it working? We've got OAA, who is threatening to take the Outdoor Retailer Show out of Utah if Utah lawmakers persist in their efforts to try to change the management of federal lands through these national monuments, through these two House concurrent resolutions. We've got the Speaker of the House and the President of the Senate behind these. They've fast-tracked them. Governor Herbert has, probably at this point when you listen to this, has signed both of them. Each side seems to be playing chicken. No side is giving in. Is there real leverage here?
I think that that's obviously to be seen. We just really can't know yet. However, a couple things. The two resolutions, one appeals to the Congress, one appeals to the president. So the political leaders in the state feel like they have friends in Washington. They pulled out the stops and they got the big guns in the state legislature to back these resolutions and to move them forward. So yes, there's that political pressure on the one hand. But then on the other hand, the outdoor industry, if they redo their economic impact analysis and it turns out to be $800 billion. I mean, that's a hard thing for the other, 530 members of, or 529 members of Congress to ignore that amount of economic energy. So I think that it could be very exciting. Outdoor Industry Association has called all of its members to a meeting in Washington in April. I think the members of the legislature, as I said earlier, their language is that they're not totally blowing off the industry. They're saying, well, we care about those people. We don't want them to go. They know that they belong here.
It sounds like a lonely person to be is if you're the rock climber who also doesn't like federal lands. It's like, where did that guy fit in?
This is shaping up to be one of the biggest issues of the legislative session, and I'm sure we'll be talking about it again on 45 days as we move forward. One more thing I want to talk about that happened on Wednesday this week. Lawmakers considered some bills in the House Government Operations Committee on elections reforms. And HB 204 was one of the bills that was considered and I believe passed out of committee. It would allow for a state-funded presidential primary, which is really important considering what happened in our caucuses last year, our presidential caucuses. Nicole, you covered the hearing. This really is a reaction to what happened last year, right?
Yeah, and we remember those caucuses last year. They were so chaotic. You had lines going out the door and wrapping around blocks. You had people standing in line waiting to cast a vote for 2 to 3 hours. You had precincts running out of ballots. It was pretty mad. It was pretty much madness on caucus night in March last year. So this is a reaction to that. The sponsor of HB 204 is Democratic Representative Patrice Arendt. And she got up there and appealed to the lawmakers on the House Government Operations Committee and said, and she took us back to caucus night last year.
We all thought we had huge turnouts because of the lines and the number of people that showed up at the caucus meetings. Actually, that night, in terms of the presidential caucus, and there were two different caucuses going on, we had a 53% lower turnout than we did when we had our last big presidential primary in 2008.
So after the caucuses, people were pretty upset. I mean, there were a lot of people that didn't even go out and vote because they saw photos of the lines on Facebook. There was no early voting. You couldn't mail in a ballot. So Representative Arendt also mentioned a lot of her constituents that complained to her because they had kids that they had to take care of. They couldn't take a couple hours to go vote at a caucus on a Tuesday night. And there were veterans that were ill and just all these reasons. They had to work. So she thinks that this is really important to have a state-funded primary instead of the caucuses next year, or I guess in 2020 for the next presidential election, instead of the caucuses. And so to prove her point, she said she's a Democrat, obviously super minority in the state. She said that this shouldn't be a political issue. And to prove that, she brought the state Democratic chair, Peter Caroon, and the state Republican chair, James Evans, to come and support her bill. And Peter Caroon, the Democratic chair, seemed pretty excited about it. I think it was the Democrats mostly who had the big problems with running out of ballots and all that stuff. They weren't used to having so many people at their caucuses.
Well, Republicans had online voting that night, or they were trying out online voting,
right,
but they were funding that through their own party funds.
Yeah.
Democrats were taking paper ballots and shoving them into cardboard boxes.
Exactly.
They didn't have, I talked to Peter Caroon about that on the morning of caucus night, and he told me that they just don't have the funds. They needed that state funding. Wrapping up really quickly, Nicole, let's talk about a couple other bills that were thrown out there in that hearing that night.
Yeah, so this committee on Wednesday seemed to want to go in the direction to make it easier to vote in Utah. And there was another bill, HB 230, that was sponsored by Representative Brad Daw. He's a Republican. That requires county clerks, if you mail in your ballot, if you're in a vote-by-mail county and you send in your ballot and there's a problem with it, the signature doesn't match or any other reason, that would make it so that the county clerks have a responsibility to reach out to you in a timely manner so that you can fix that problem and that your vote is counted. That bill would also require counties that want to do the vote-by-mail to pay for the return postage so that you don't have to worry about going out and finding a stamp. One of the representatives mentioned that is important because a lot of millennials nowadays don't have stamps because they do everything online. There was another bill that was held, and this was a bill, HB 159, that would, I think Representative Handy is the one who sponsored that. When you go to the DMV to get a license or to renew your license, right now you can check a box to update your voter registration with your driver's license. And this bill would make it so that instead of doing an opt-in, change my voter registration box, it's an opt-out, so that a lot more people would automatically have their voter registration updated with their driver's license. And a lot of people think that is the case now, that when you change your driver's license, your new voting address or whatever is updated as well, but it's not. So that contributed, they said, to a lot of confusion last year. In the weeks leading up to Election Day in November, people thought they were registered at their current address and they actually weren't. So
Nicole, why do you think that in effect died?
I'm not sure if it actually died. It might come back. They were running out of time. This committee went pretty long, but there was a concern floated that there were people who might not want their information public. It would go in a voter database automatically unless you hit this opt-out box. Someone mentioned domestic violence victims and other people who are concerned about having their information out there. So I think this sounds like it had a lot of support, actually, but there were a couple small concerns. I think it will come back, and they'll talk about it more. That's HB 159.
Great. We'll keep an eye on it. Judy Faiz, Lee Hale, Nicole Nixon, thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
45 Days is a production of KUER News. JT Nebaker composed our music. Tim Slover and myself produced this episode. I'm Terry Gilday.